Tim. Joe Tim.
Senator Braun, I'm Joe Tim, Assistant Administrator of the Children's Services Division. Don Miller, the Division Administrator, is to be here and present his testimony. He's currently in a meeting with the juvenile court judges over in the Public Service Building and is unable to be here. We have combined to make a number of major points, which Don was to present to the committee today. And I'll try to be very brief about these. Our analysis of the bill leaves us with some confusion as to what the terminology on line 5 of the bill, specifically the phrase special treatment, actually means. Now, we've analyzed it based upon two assumptions. One is that special treatment refers to very special kinds of cases of youngsters who are in need of medical care or treatment based upon physical, mental, or emotional conditions. This assumption is related to the fact that much of the difficulty that has existed between the courts, the juvenile courts, and the Children's Services Division over the past 2 years has been very much related to these very hard to place youngsters, these seriously disturbed youngsters, and in a couple of instances, very physically handicapped kinds of kids. And we see this, based upon this assumption, it would appear that we're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of about 50 to 75 children whom we would categorize as being seriously emotionally disturbed and in need of specialized treatment. Now, if you price out the cost of care for these children at $50 a day for a period of a year or over a biennium, you come up with a rather large amount of money, somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 million for 50 youngsters being cared for at $50 a day over a two-year period.
What does it cost per month?
For one of these particular youngsters, figure it at $50 a day times 30 days. That would be a rough figure. That'd be $1,500.
How much is that a year?
That measures out. For one youngster over a period of a year, that would be somewhere in the neighborhood of, what, $17,000 per year per youngster.
How
multiply that.
The child cost at Hillcrest?
About $1,200 a year at Hillcrest. And somewhere just over $1,000 per, I'm sorry, that would be, Duane Shimpack, you're here, what is it? $1,200 a year at Hillcrest.
Hillcrest is the higher one, and just over $1,000
at
McLaren. Oh, well, no,
both are. A month.
A month, yes. So you're talking about, what, somewhere in the neighborhood of $12,000 to $15,000 a year for a girl at Hillcrest and $12,000 a year for a boy at McLaren.
You're a mandamus in Multnomah County, weren't you?
That's correct.
The plan. Why don't you tell us about that case?
Well, there have been a number of cases in which the administrator and the previous administrator and even the director of the Department of Human Resources have been subpoenaed for two cases in Multnomah County. And these have been one of a kind. These have been youngsters who have been committed to the Children's Services Division for service. These are youngsters whom we describe as hardcore kinds of kids, younger youngsters, in most instances 9 or 10 years of age, 13 or 14 in one or two instances. These are youngsters who have remained in detention for a considerable period of time. Youngsters in a couple of cases who have been in detention 6 months or 8 months.
Whose fault is that?
Well, insofar as the Children's Services Division must accept custody and must plan for the children, it's the fault of the Children's Services Division that we have not been able to find placement resources for these kids. As you know, the mandatory the mandatory language in statute that made it, makes it necessary for the Children's Division to pick up on every youngster committed was effected on, what, July 1, 1971. Prior to that time, the Public Welfare Division could accept or could reject a referral from any juvenile court in the state. That's no longer possible. So we have found ourselves playing catch-up ball in terms of trying to get programs to move along to the point where we can react and make unnecessary these long stays of youngsters in detention. I think we've come a long way. As you're probably aware, we have now mounted six programs for the younger, seriously emotionally disturbed children throughout the state. Three of these are 24-hour residential programs, and three of these are day treatment programs. The residential programs, because of fire requirements in the relation to the facilities, can only hold five youngsters apiece. So we have an average daily population potential of only 15 youngsters for the residential part of that program. The other three programs, which are day treatment programs in the Dalles and Eugene and Salem, have a capacity for up to 15 children on a daycare basis. As you are well aware, we also assume responsibility for contracting for Edgefield Lodge just a year ago, and there's been some absorption of youngsters in that particular program. But we're still caught. We're still behind the eight ball in not being able to come up with the right kinds of placement facilities for some of these hardcore youngsters.
What is the fee, Madam Chairman,
Perry Center.
Yeah. That's the highest priced place in town.
We have just readjusted, with the emergency board's approval, all of the rates of the private residential centers, and Perry is now running about $30 per day per child. All of the residential centers, like Christie and St. Mary's, are somewhere in the $20 bracket per day per child.
Are the facilities available better than Perry Center? In terms of, you said $50 a day, where would you spend that money?
Yeah, I think the centers that we have, the private residential centers, these three I mentioned, 24-hour care, because they have a low capacity, their costs are reaching toward $50 a day. If we were able to put more kids in there, a seven or eight or even nine children, then you're,
Are they of high professional quality?
Yes, they have. They're well-staffed programs.
Who runs them?
And we have followed the model of developing private corporations in each one of these communities, and they're operated then on a policy level by their own private board.
Well, Madam Chair, what I'm driving at here is that Mr. Stern and I have worked together on this for many years. A place like Perry Center that operates under a purchase-to-care concept, I guess what I'm wondering is it possible through that avenue to encourage Perry Center to expand and take care of this need, not to gear up the backlog that's once taken care of is going to be passing unused, but to increase the capacity.
Yes, we have just, in response to your question, not in relation to Perry, but we have just entered into an arrangement with Albertina Kerr, and they have indicated, and you'll be implementing this within a week or two, that they are willing to accept up to 10 youngsters, regardless of the age range, and build them into what we would call a sort of staging area program. In other words, we would be able to take the 9-year-old out of the Multnomah County Detention Facility or out of the Lane County Facility and buy service for that youngster into this new 10-bed program that Albertina Kerr is going to be setting up within a matter of weeks or a month. I can't give you a hard deadline on that. This is an expedient, and I think it's going to take some of the pressure off.
Why do you use the word expedient?
It's an expedient in the sense that we have not had the opportunity to do planning over a period of 3 months or 4 months with Albertina Kerr. They have just finished remodeling part of their building where they now have available a separate area for 10 beds. And so they've been willing to
fill in the breach in terms of our problem in the Multnomah County area.
Well, this backlog, I know, is very, very burdensome, but with this facility, that's going to pick away at that, isn't it?
It's going to pick away at it.
Now, in a year, will that get that down, or are you going to have two or three of those to get it down?
The other plan that's afoot is the, which we have in our budget, which Ways and Means has not addressed as yet, is the development of a special facility in the gear unit out of McLaren School for, ultimately, 16 youngsters, seriously emotionally disturbed youngsters whom we have not been able to place or maintain in placement at the community level. And this program we would hope to have underway as soon as the budget is approved after July 1. We would hopefully take 8 youngsters in initially and then build up to a capacity of 16 youngsters and be broken out into 2 groups. The younger age group of youngsters, the 8, 9, 10-year-old group, and then an older age group of 11, 12, and 13-year-old young
people. Well, then, what's wrong with this bill? You're going to be doing this.
If
you don't have a plan, you shouldn't even start.
Well,
I know you got a plan.
The problem with the bill, essentially, is that if we move planning responsibility back to the court, where the court can direct what planning is to take place for a youngster, foster care, specialized treatment in a particular facility, then the planning responsibility is removed from the administrative agency, namely CSD, and we cannot claim federal dollars because of that arrangement.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I want to save time. Now, this is a very powerfully attacked in juvenile code committee, as you know,
right,
about perhaps the kids that fall through the cracks. Are there any program under a bureaucracy, which those of you can run a state with, they're bound to be places that get lost? And it looks like this helps to keep kids from getting lost. And so I don't tell me how good a job you're doing, because I know you're doing the best you can. But who's going to ride herd on you? That's what I want to know.
There is in the new juvenile code a section that will make it mandatory for all cases, all youngsters committed to CSD, to be reviewed on an annual basis by the juvenile court. So the courts are building in their own monitoring procedure, which I think is very necessary.
Well, then would you suggest we hold this bill until we get the juvenile bill, and if it doesn't go right, we take this bill and...
I think if you go for this bill, you would have to recognize that the planning that is directed by the juvenile courts will have to be funded out of general fund money, and we will not be able to use federal match for these youngsters.
Well, will you tell us about the case where you were mandamus in Portland?
Which one? The most recent one?
I don't know. Have you had several?
Let me give you an example of one. The first case that we were subpoenaed on occurred, if I remember correctly, late last summer, early fall. This was a youngster, 8 or 9 years of age, and typical of all of these kids, he has been through the mill. He's been in foster care. He has been...
How many foster homes?
I can't tell you, Senator Brown. I don't have the detail of that particular case.
Who can?
I'm sorry. I would say that there were numerous foster homes, from 2 to 6 foster homes, and I can get you detail on each one of these cases if you would like vignettes on each one of them. If it would be helpful to the committee, I'll arrange to do that.
Go ahead.
This particular youngster, if I remember correctly, had also been to Perry Center when he was a youngster. They addressed the younger groups, the younger age group. He had also been to St. Mary's, if I'm not mistaken. We had simply petered out as far as resources were concerned, and he ended up in Boys Unit 1 in the detention home. Now, let me depart just to mention this, that many of the difficulties we have in relation to Multnomah County occurred after July 1 of last year, when Multnomah County felt the fiscal crunch and decided to close out Edgefield and also closed out their Boys 1 unit, a unit for 20 youngsters, which traditionally, going back over 20 years, they had always used as a treatment situation for youngsters and had been tolerant, and I'll have to say tolerant, with the inability of the community and in general to provide for these youngsters. So it became a treatment center for youngsters. Now that was closed out as of last July 1. All right, this youngster remained in detention for a long period of time while CSD staff in Multnomah County attempted to provide for him. Judge Lewis decided that CSD had to bite the bullet on it. And she gave us notice that she wanted a plan at a certain CSD to come up with a plan by a certain date. We didn't have a plan, and she was setting a court hearing, and she was subpoenaing in responsible CSD officials. We were not able to come up with a plan. The particular people were cited in and indicated the problems that we were faced with. We, at the same time, of course, were trying very hard to find a plan. And we had begun to explore the possibility of this boy being accepted into the Southern Oregon Treatment Center. This was the first treatment program established for the five youngsters in residence at Ashland. And they agreed, subsequent to that hearing, to accept this youngster into residence down there. So we had the situation of a Multnomah County resident, a little youngster, being placed in a resource down in Southern Oregon, which doesn't sit well with us and probably doesn't sit well with the people down there. We had to undertake this kind of planning in this case. Another youngster, we were able to work out an arrangement, finally, and this was a subpoena case, for this youngster to be placed with relatives with whom he had an identification. This is in Multnomah County. But it was impossible for us, because of present statute, to pay a board payment for this youngster in the home of the relatives. As you know, we cannot pay a foster care payment for a youngster in the home of a relative and or a step-parent. Now, the new juvenile code will change this, and we will be able to make a payment. So in this case, we're using what we call crisis care money, which is in the Child Study and Treatment Center budget that was appropriated by the and approved by the E Board a year ago, January. We're using some of that so-called crisis care money to pay these relatives a board payment to take care of this youngster. But he is not included under Title 19 for medical expenses. So as a result, there are no medical monies for this youngster available. And CSD is not budgeted for any medical service outside of what is available through Title 19. So if he breaks his nose or needs a tonsillectomy, I don't know who's going to pay for it. We don't have the resources. And yet he is a youngster committed to our care and custody. There have still been a couple of other cases, and I'm trying to sort them out. They're not atypical from the ones I've just mentioned to you. We have, in one other instance I might mention, we were able to literally twist the arm, and this is another subpoena case, twist the arm of the people at Edgefield who accepted a youngster on a 5-day-a-week basis for treatment and residence, and we then paid for him on a weekend out at Cedar Hills, which is a private psychiatric treatment situation in the Portland area. So we've had to simply stretch and twist a few arms in order to do as much as we have done, and yet we are not satisfied that we're doing the job. Let me make my final point. I like the law the way it is. I think that the administrative agency, and I think Don agrees with me, or I agree with Don, I should turn it around, that the administrative agency should be able to provide the services that are necessary. And we should not have to have the court hounding us with subpoenas to do our job. But at the same time, we have to come back and hit up the legislature for what it takes at that level. And it isn't all on their back, because we have a lot of work to do in the area of planning resources. As an example, I don't think we have worked with the private agencies, the Perrys, the Louises, and the St. Marys, sufficiently to get them to meet their responsibilities for some of these youngsters. And that's all.
Questions?
I'm not dissatisfied yet, Madam Chairman. this bill is a very simple bill, and as I see it, all it says is that every child can have a plan. You say you're going to lose federal money to plan because you got to go back to juvenile judge. Now, I know you understand this better than I do, but how, like, you still have custody of the child, and all it says is you're going to tell a judge what your plans are, and if he doesn't like them, or he says, come back again tomorrow with a new plan, that's not taking them out of your charge. Why did you lose your federal support?
Well, I think as long as you have on line 9 and 10, the plan may be approved, modified, or disapproved by the court, it puts in the hands of the court an authority or responsibility that the federal say should be maintained completely by the state agency, the CSD.
Madam Chairman, I wonder if you could get us some interpretation from higher, from federal authority on this, and if that confirms what he says, maybe he could bring us some other language for this last sentence.
Well, that'd be a good idea. Senator Irish.
How much money are we talking about in the way of federal funds? What would we lose, roughly?
I would say we'd lose roughly in the neighborhood of... Now, it depends. If we take a second assumption that this planning responsibility of special treatment would extend to more than the small number of youngsters who are seriously emotionally disturbed or physically handicapped, but would extend to youngsters who are placed in all of our foster care programs, in all of our child care centers and private residential agencies, then we're talking about $20 million of federal money. If we're talking about just the smaller universe of kids, let's say 75 or 100 at the most, then I think we're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,100,000, $1,200,000 a year of federal money.
H.E.W. man was in town today. I was in my office, he was in my office an hour ago.
Bring money?
Well, he brought me some books I didn't want. Did you hear?
Another lady wished to testify and gave her written testimony to us. Is that bill 2114 in here? I mean, health bill? Yeah. John Darby, would you state your name?
Yes, Carolyn Downs, member of the committee. I'm John Darby. I'm director of the Adult Parole Probation section of the Corrections Division. Originally, when House Bill 2114 was before the House Judiciary, we did oppose the bill in its original form. The primary reason at the time was that we did not feel that the probation staff could adequately handle the types of cases that we would be referred to us, especially mental disease and mental defects. Secondly, was the lack of staffing throughout the state. Thirdly, we felt that a person that was acquitted of an offense did not have the responsibility and particularly the obligation that putting them into a correctional setting would not be the proper stance. At the same time, we recognized and sincerely felt the court's position they were in having someone handle these types of persons. The bill again, has now has an amendment to it, and we are here today withdrawing any previous comments, and we're for the bill with its amendment, for the reason that it now gives the court a wide array of resources in the community. They can go to mental health, they can go to the local county, they can go to any person, and it just doesn't stipulate that they would go to a probation officer. We felt that we would be certainly ill-equipped as probation and parole officers to be involved with the mental defect and the disease, a person having problems, behavior, act out, especially when the statutory requirements are that the person has to be duly convicted of a crime before it could be referred to us. But primarily, we would support the bill now because it does give the court a wide array. I have no further
questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Donner. Delbert Cole.
I have written testimony here.
Thank you. Did you get one, George?
No, I haven't. For the record, I'm Dr. Delbert Cole, Assistant Administrator for the Mental Health Division. House Bill 2114 refers to persons not guilty of a crime by reason of mental disease or defect who present a substantial danger to themselves or to others, but who, in the opinion of the court, could be treated on an outpatient basis. This bill seeks to clarify who is responsible for supervision of these persons, a point left undefined in existing statutes. In the engrossed measure, the court may appoint any person or state, county, or local agency it considers capable to assume the supervision of these mentally disordered persons, subject to conditions established by the court. No criteria are listed in the bill to determine whether the person or agency a person or agency is capable of supervising these mentally disordered persons. Conceivably, a private citizen, an individual police officer, a health department, a mental health clinic, or any other agency could be designated to be responsible for supervision and would have no choice but to assume this responsibility. The community mental health programs do not have expertise in enforcement or the manpower and resources needed to perform the supervisory function. The Mental Health Division proposes that the court have the option of referring persons defined in this bill to the Mental Health Division for predisposition evaluation. If the division recommends and the person consents, the court could refer the person to the Mental Health Division or its designee for treatment. Since this would be an additional workload for community mental health programs for which they are not funded, costs of evaluation and treatment should be supported by the county or the referring court. The requirements for supervision in the engrossed bill could create serious problems, as already mentioned. It's my understanding that the probation department of the corrections division has the organization and the expertise to perform this function, but with an active average caseload of 85 persons or so, is not adequately staffed to provide meaningful supervision for this population. Under ORS 137-590, local jurisdictions are prohibited from establishing paid full-time professional probation services accountable to the courts. It would appear to us that the most effective system would be one where decisions on supervision and treatment are made by the court, and the court has the fiscal responsibility for these services. Section 274 of Engrossed Senate Bill 80 would amend ORS 137-590 to allow probation services accountable to local courts. If that amendment is enacted, and if this committee accepts the recommendations of the Mental Health Division regarding evaluation and treatment and payment, the division would support Engrossed Bill 2114. It should improve supervision available to these mentally disturbed persons and provide a valuable treatment alternative to state hospitalization. As a separate issue, flexibility in the treatment of those individuals hospitalized under subsection 2, subsection 1 of this bill would be improved if they could be hospitalized at any state mental hospital designated by the division rather than only at Oregon State Hospital. Just as some persons can be treated on an outpatient basis, others do not require the maximum security available only at Oregon State Hospital. We view these individuals as having a being on a continuum or a range in terms of their ability of self-control. From those who have essentially no self-control requiring absolute observation and security, to those who really are able to maintain themselves quite well with very limited supervision. In fact, as we view the population defined in this bill, it appears to us that many of these people, in fact, do need treatment, which we could provide, and would require supervision only to the extent of having someone to report to at periodic intervals, or to whom we could report if they break their treatment contract. Under these conditions, we do feel we have a service to offer them, and that with the conditions outlined, we'd be very happy to do so.
Questions of Dr. Cole.
Did you bring these guys up to the hospital?
No, we did not. We were in Ways and Means Committee at the time and simply weren't able to get our testimony prepared at that time. This is the first presentation of these particular amendments. There is a marked up copy of the bill here, which contains the amendments that I've spoken to, or recommended amendments.
Another question on the chairman.
Senator
Hoyt. Does it say that state law now prohibits any local jurisdiction from having its own parole or filing probation or...
That's correct. Yeah. There's a specific phrase in the criminal code which prevents any state local agency from having paid probation services. This is in the engrossed Senate Bill 80 as it's being deleted. And we see this as a very desirable thing. It seems to us by far the simplest thing. In some cases, really all that's needed is a clerk that keeps the records that would be an employee of the court. And I think with that combination, we can function very well. It does, the amendment to Senate Bill 80 would provide, of course, for an entire probation kind of apparatus if the county so desires and saw the need.
Further questions? Thank you, Dr. Paul. Yet the other three bills are the traffic bills, so I'm going to turn it over to you.
If I don't think you've got one, the other two will take the other one.
Well, you can go ahead.
No. Captain Kistner is here.
Yeah, right.
So we start on 284 then, please. Mr. Wallace, is that Jim Wallace?
Mattis.
Mattis, thank you.
Thanks, sir. I'm Jim Mattis, and I'm really here speaking not only on behalf of myself as an attorney, but also mostly for Richard Curtis, who is the president of the Oregon Municipal Judges Association. And I think that, at least as we spoke in reference to 284 in the Transportation Committee, we spoke in reference to both 283 and 284 as they are rather companion measures. They both would, in a very short order, get city courts and also JT courts out of the business of trying major traffic offenses in the state, either as a state statute or as a municipal ordinance. We have several cities in order for city attorneys, for example, to prosecute in the municipal court. Most of our cities adopt the Oregon Traffic Code by reference to enable that. These two bills together would preclude that happening. Rich Curtis's main comment that he wants to leave with you is that he would say on behalf of the judges that this would is a variance with at least probably their philosophy that we would like to know and have explained what it is, what the problem is that would necessitate the removal of local officials officiating in this area. If it's an attempt to gain more uniformity of sentencing and we question that because we probably have as much variance in the sentencing among district courts as is true from one court system to another in the area. It has the same type of questions, it raises the same type of problems that other bills in previous sessions before this legislature have had to grapple with, and that is a problem of convenience for one thing. For example, if this were to pass in Florence, it would necessitate both defendants, witnesses, police officers traveling to Eugene in order to have the case tried and heard. Unless the district court were to assume some circuit riding type capacity. It obviously has implications fiscally for the state courts as well as docket implications for them because they would be the forum for hearing all of these types of major traffic measures. I have also a problem with, most specifically, Senate Bill 284, which I think probably does something that is not intended, even in terms of purpose, but I don't know how you get around it either, because you have to draft in this way if you're going to try and get the purpose. That bill, lines 4 through 7, which is the main guts of it, except for the last line, is redundant with present statutory material. I would refer your counsel to ORS 483.036, subsection 1. So the only new material that is in there is in reference to the last line on line 8. And that's the one that is truly preempts the field. Up until that point, and under our present statutory provision, 430361, local authorities may not conflict with state criminal and traffic concerns. That does not preclude local authorities from supplementing it, either in terms of adopting the verbatim, the statutory material, or supplementing it as long as they don't conflict with it. And many cities, including Eugene and many others, and you can hear from the city attorney for Beaverton, Beaverton has also done, have supplemented it in one respect in terms of making the major traffic offenses apply on other property open to public travel. That is, property that is not a state highway as defined in our state statute. If this is written into the law, that precludes local authorities from making this type of a supplementary action.
What type of traffic do you refer to that isn't on designated highways? Is that like motorcycle climbs on a hill or something?
No, well, it would be any type of, as it relates to the major traffic offenses, which is drug driving, or anything of this nature, accidents, that occur other than on highways. The highway is a publicly maintained way, so this would include territory, shopping lots, shopping
lots. In your opinion, do you think that if, dealing with the same, that was deleted, but under the existing law, that they can't do anything that's in conflict with the provisions thereof. Do you think an increased penalty, would this be in conflict?
An increased penalty?
Yes, if the city had the same crime, et cetera, by ordinance, but provided a stiffer penalty, would you figure that this was in conflict with state statute?
We have at least, although we don't have any, appellate court decision on that issue, unless somebody would correct me. We do have out of what was the Portland Municipal Court, opinion which did declare that to be the case, that they would try and extract more. Most cities have adopted in this state the Uniform Traffic Ordinance, which the Bureau of Criminal Research and Service, and the Times Research Attorney also, put together, and it utilizes an adoption reference that picks up the same statutory act, so they are identical in most cities.
Did you have several different bills here? You stretched yourself to several of them.
No, just 283 and 284.
284. And let's see, 351, is that sort of the same while you're there? No, that's a different one.
No,
I should have probably called one of the proponents of one of these bills for first, but I hope you'll save a few minutes, because some of the things that you've mentioned have come to our attention before, and I hope before sentinel was thrashed over the mouth. I wonder if Mr. Roberts would testify next week. You're talking on just 284, is that right? Oh, no. On 351, 200. All of them. Name it, start at 283. That's the closest one.
Thank you.
I
want to
know if this is a duly constituted committee.
We had a quorum, Senator, and we welcome you to our group.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now we have 100% attendance.
Now I have a little bill.
Well, okay.
File it properly. So, Paul, the district attorney. Yeah. How about that?
Let's make it retroactive for about 10 minutes.
How do I like that?
Over the winter.
Okay. Can you imagine having been the district attorney of Cook County?
Has a certain build, smart man. He's not district attorney of Cook County.
Hell no.
Has certain characteristics which can't be met anywhere else.
We will not be converted from the main public to meeting. Please proceed.
My name is Phil Roberts. I'm representing Oregon District Attorney's Association. We were not directly involved in the preparation or submission of these bills in the first place, but after having reviewed 283 and 284 specifically, we did come to a conclusion as to what our position was, and I can't really say anything about the thoughts and the minds of the people that drafted the bill. 284, which is the one which would establish sole state authority, we do favor. Simply, and here again, I don't know why the bill was drafted originally, but we do feel that in the field of major traffic offenses, this is not all traffic regulation, but only the major ones. We feel that they are important enough that they should be treated on the level of a crime. And, of course, there's some talk of providing alternative treatment for lesser traffic offenses, and maybe others shouldn't be treated this way. But for those that are major enough to be considered as a crime, we think that it should be state offenses in all cases if they're going to be prosecuted as a crime. We think it's a state concern, a statewide concern, and not just a matter of local concern. 283, on the other hand, would create some real problems because it would require the prosecution to be in a district court in any county that had one. And many counties which have district courts also have one, two, three, four, or more justice courts and municipal courts, both of which would have to turn over their caseloads in this field to district court. And we think, frankly, that probably district court wouldn't have the manpower to handle it in a county like Marion County, where you have JP courts and several municipal courts. We just don't see how it's possible for this to be done without some drastic overhaul in the manpower of the district court system and some additional judges and things of that sort. It would appear, to our association, it appeared that probably the reasoning behind this bill, S-283, is to get the major traffic offenses, again, those offenses which are serious, not simply a matter of going a little too fast or something like that, but a serious traffic offense like driving while intoxicated, for instance, to get those before a legally trained judge. This appeared to us to probably be one of the purposes of the bill, because there are a lot of JPs and probably a number of municipal judges in the smaller areas who are part-time and don't have legal training. Now, if that's right, and we're only assuming that this is the purpose behind the bill, if that's right, we can sympathize, because I'm sure many district attorneys throughout the state would like to see legally trained judges in all cases that are really serious cases. But again, we feel that the problems posed by doing it in this fashion, just passing one bill that says from now on all of these cases have to be in district court, simply doesn't take into consideration the logistics problems, the manpower problems of courtrooms and judges to handle caseloads.
So aren't these bills that Jim said, Jim Ellis had
drafted? I believe that's right. I haven't talked to him myself. Bob Lucas has talked to him several times, and I rather expected that he would be here today. The only time I talked to him was when these bills were before Senate Transportation, and we just talked very briefly then.
Well, you don't have any problem with 283, do you?
Well, 283 is the one problem would exist, yes, because that has to do with the court.
Well, yeah, but it says only in those counties
which have a district court.
then it would eliminate JP and municipal courts. Well, there are a lot of JP and municipal courts in counties which have district courts. And then Marion County is a good example. They have a district court here in Salem. They also have JP and municipal courts in Silverton and Staten and I don't know how many other places in this county. And so there are several other courts whose caseloads in this field would be turned over to district courts.
Well, if this were enacted and it was a county that didn't have a district court, then the circuit court, along with the JPs, would have jurisdiction.
Yeah, there would be no change in those counties. The JPs would still handle it, so it wouldn't get at the problem of the JPs in those counties where there is a district court anyway. Which, of course, brings us back to the point, maybe we need to establish some more district courts throughout the state. That's a different problem.
I'm curious to know, I'm not smart enough to tell the really substantive differences in terms of effect between 283 and 284.
I'm not sure that I know all of the ramifications of the effect of 284 either. The witness who just spoke, I think, may be better versed in that field than I am, and Mr. Ashmanskas from Beaverton may be better versed than I am, too. But from a simple philosophical viewpoint, our association approved it simply because we feel that the major offenses are statewide concerns and ought to be a matter of state law and should be uniform law applicable everywhere. Now, I realize there may be some problems that we have taken into consideration in terms of whether a city can then extend those regulations to roads or streets, for instance, which would not be covered under the state traffic code. I don't know whether that's a problem or not.
About the matter of logistics, it might be that it's a matter of priorities or value judgments. From a man is murdered, you don't worry about whether you're taking the district court or not, either, or the county seat.
Well, no, but...
Well, okay.
No,
we'll take care of the mortgage.
Right.
I got the wrong guy. You know
right.
What I'm talking
about. Felonies go to circuit court.
Yeah.
There's no question about that.
And you don't worry about the logistics?
No.
If it's in Beaverton, you don't worry about taking the Hillsborough, do you?
Well, no. The problem is we're not making a change there. We're not talking here. I'm not so concerned here about the distances involved as I am concerned about setting a date and saying after this date, all of these cases are dumped on another court, which hasn't had time to increase its manpower to be able to handle
it. Well, it has ramifications, too, with respect to the district attorney.
Right.
Going if he's passed this, then district attorney Ray Robinette is going to have five more deputies.
This is a problem which would arise under 284. The district attorneys would all want to be involved in a lot more cases than they are now, too.
Don't you think it would be better if the attorney general called?
Well, somehow or another, it seems like we evade the real issue. When we say that we don't have enough attorneys, district attorneys, or too far to the courthouse, when the real attempt in all these is to really put into effect what I think that the people of the state of Oregon are demanding, that these major violations are not patty cake anymore, no slap on the wrist, but they're just, they're, you want to call them a felony, and the fact is there's a bill that says it's on the law of felony. And if you're going to put that from that point of view, I think that's what the legislature this time has to do. They've got to start to make up their mind just what's important.
Okay, I'll agree. And from the viewpoint of the logistics, I think probably most of the objections that our association has come up with to 283 could probably be solved by such a simple thing, perhaps, as putting an effective date on here, a year or so in the future, and then giving at least one budgetary period for the district court to budget for the increased caseload. Now, perhaps that's the solution that we're talking about. I don't know. As far as considering them serious is concerned, I agree that we are going to have to decide whether or not traffic, which of course is one of the biggest killers in the country today, is serious enough to do something about. But again, I'm not sure that simply transferring it to district court is going to automatically make it a more serious offense, because I know of district courts who treat these offenses with less, as matters of less concern and importance than some municipal courts do. So I don't know whether you're going to gain or lose.
And you have some justices in the seat who are non-lawyers, who are better judges than some of the district and circuit court judges.
That's true. It varies from case to case. I know JPs who would not send a man to jail for DUIL, and I know of district judges who probably wouldn't either. So that's really about all I can say. 351, if you want me to mention it while I'm here, we favor it, and that's about all I can say about it. It simply extends the present, all of the amendments contained in 351 are contained also in another bill, I don't remember the number of it, with the exception of the addition on line 17, the words added on line 17, in actual physical control. Those words, we think, pretty much covered by present law, but only on a circumstantial basis, and we think that they should be written in there. They are in other states, and again, this is line 17, in actual physical control. The reason this was drafted is to cover the case where you find a man who is drunk in the car, but he's not actually moving the vehicle. He's sitting alongside of the road, the hood's warm, and he obviously has been driving the thing, but when the police officer arrives, he's not driving, and he says to the police officer, although he's sitting under the wheel of the car and his key is in the ignition, he says to the officer, "Oh, I wasn't driving, my friend was driving, and he just took off across the field to walk home," this kind of thing happens. Well, there have been cases where the Oregon courts have held that this is sufficient circumstantial evidence to show driving, but there are other states who have avoided that circumstantial problem by saying he doesn't have to be observed driving the vehicle. If he's in control of the vehicle and he's intoxicated and the vehicle is on a highway, that's sufficient to violate the statute. So this is what we're putting in here. I don't say we're putting in. This was done by, I believe, the Traffic Safety Commission. It's one of the governor's bills. But we do favor it because we think it clarifies the law. Probably already is the law, but it spells it out much better.
What is the difference between present law and what's on line 21 in that actual effect?
There's no difference in the effect on the maximum jail sentence. I think there may be a difference in effect on... No?
Well,
the fine is the same too.
It's an unclassified... It wasn't... When we passed the criminal code 2 years ago, the traffic code isn't part of it,
right.
And it had the specific punishment in 483 for traffic, and then we had a boilerplate statute in the criminal code that classified misdemeanors. All this simply extends the classification of what the penalty is now.
It doesn't make any change. The penalty that's listed under the existing law, which would be deleted in lines 19 and 20, is exactly the same as for Class A misdemeanors.
Well, it's not investment for it. It's like 6 months or 500 maximum.
Right? Isn't there another penalty someplace else about driving under the influence?
No, the penalty as far as I'm aware. Well, 0.15, which is another problem. The 0.15 or higher statute. Now, there is a difference, however, up on line 13. On reckless driving, it would make a Class A misdemeanor out of it, too, and it's now the equivalent of about a Class B or C. I don't know. It's in between. It does not match any of the present classifications. This bill would make a uniform classification out of it.
Did you comment on all the bills that you were going to comment on?
I believe so. Just the three traffic bills.
Yeah. I wonder if John from Beaverton, I can't read his writing.
City attorney from the city of Beaverton, and I'd like to speak to 283 and 284 together. At the Senate Committee, Transportation Committee, Judge Ellis did in fact speak in favor of these bills. I oppose both of them, and I speak for the city of Beaverton. Starting with Senate Bill 284, perhaps I can answer, I don't like to do this, but some of Judge Ellis's intentions as he expressed them to me, and also some of the questions that were raised. One is that on the first four lines of the section saying that no local authority shall enact any ordinances in conflict with provisions of the state law dealing with driving under the influence of driving while suspended. That is, in fact, and I concur with Mr. Mattis in his legal opinion, that's redundant under 483.036 subsection 1, also under the Constitution and also under case law. The effect of the bill itself, up to that point, of course, is to preclude city attorneys as prosecutors of those offenses and to take those offenses out of the realm of city ordinance violations. And I can see the distinction between the two, why they're two separate bills. The second point, not only are the first four lines redundant, since we cannot conflict with state law now, is that it gives us the ability, in case of a court declaring one of those provisions unconstitutional because of the statutory language, the ability to fashion a remedy before the next legislature meets. And we have an example. I brought the City of Beaverton traffic ordinance. We, in effect, in one line, adopt all the state traffic codes. I think no ifs, ands, or buts. That's it. We've adopted the motor vehicle code of the state, both as it exists at the time of the adoption of the ordinance and also all the amendments that will flow out of the legislature this year. We have a prospective or referential adoption scheme embodied in here.
The question is whether or not that's possible.
I submit that it is, based on particularly the Sharpman case and the analysis by Orval Edder of the referential provision.
Well, there's some attorney general
push for a lot in around
and I see the distinction, like the building code, for example, with future amendments not being able to do it under the I think we're doing fine. The example I give is the last session, the old BBR 2, the accident section of the speed law, of course, was changed and made failure to maintain reasonable control, and in the bill doing so was put as another statutory section number 43345, I believe.
If somebody charged with reckless and opportunity to cop out something else.
Well, no, it's the example I was going to give is that
careless driving one.
No, this is not careless. This is failure to maintain reasonable control. The courts have sustained demurs in Multnomah County, some of the judges, because at the time it was not placed in the provision in the code that had a penalty provision attached to it. In other words, they're saying in the code now, in ORS, ORS, there is no penalty attached to that provision. I think it's humbug, and but
you mean because it has a 9-9?
Because it's a session law, of course, and I would go back to the original session law rather than the code. But we obviate the problem in the City of Beaverton by merely amending the provisions of our ordinance as soon as we become aware of it, and of course we're not faced with that problem as district attorneys are in a number of, at least in Multnomah County, until the next session meets here. So it's our ability for flexibility in that regard is another important point.
Yeah. Well, she would, yeah, too.
All right. Okay. You know, I might think that I wrote the bill with Bali to the district court and the city court when it was registered and it held in the district court. And the biggest objection that I had to it being function of the municipal court was the fact that we are tying dispensing justice to a revenue. And I don't presume to suggest that in the City of Beaverton, when the revenue for fines go down, that the council or the city manager would presume to suggest to the municipal judge that he ain't charging enough on the fine. But it sure happened in the old days in Multnomah County with the municipal court. And so I've been a firm advocate of giving the independent judiciary invested with responsibility to major traffic, and we don't have that under the municipal court system. Now, maybe you've got a pure system of Beaverton, and I don't know, but I'd like you to answer that argument, and also the fact that we're doing everything we can to try to turn the tide on driving offenses. And, you know, I don't support mandatory minimums or increased penalties. I think that the real answer is the development of alternatives in terms of some of the alcohol and drug treatment programs, making the young kids go work in the park and food center, some of the educational type programs, and some of these things. We're beginning to develop these under the aegis of the state, and hopefully maybe we'll expand upon it through the State Board of Parole and Probation, which will be available to the district court, which aren't available to the municipal court. And of course, abolition of the city parole system and transfer of offenders to the state board, and then we merge the municipal district court system in Portland. You know, I think it's been a salutary thing. Well, if we perpetuate major traffic offenses within the municipal court jurisdiction, we preclude the judges from that flexibility that they have under the state system. So those are two things I'd like to discuss.
Yeah. Well, as far as the fine money goes, perhaps just two comments. We have a budget committee tonight, when I go back, and I think our proposed Beaver General Fund, not the total budget, which is $7 or $8 million, but I believe our proposed general fund is up some 35% this year as proposed, and the amount would be $1.8 million, roughly $1.9 million, somewhere in there.
For the court?
No, this is for the city. We're small potatoes. It's about $1,900,000 in the general fund. The fine revenue last year was budgeted at, I was going down, the library thing was $4,000, but the fine revenue municipal court, I believe, was budgeted at $60,000. And the proposed budget has, I believe, either $64,000 or $66,000 in there. And I think $60,000 of $1,900,000 is, you know, the city is not relying on the municipal court to find new streets. That's the relationship with fine money. The second item is that our court has not been reluctant to put people in jail. Not everybody. I don't agree with the minimum mandatory minimum myself, personally. We have, in fact, I would admit we probably break even if you look in the sense of revenue generated by major traffic offenses as opposed to what we pay the county for jailing. For example, if we send someone for 6 months at $8.75 a day, $8.75 a day, I'm sure, I'm not positive, but I think it balances out a good many of the fine money that comes in. And of course, I've always viewed the municipal court revenue as simply the tip of the iceberg, and I look at it as a whole system. I've never done a cost analysis of the time I spend or the judge's salary or things of that nature. I've never done that, but that's one, and how much fine money we get. And the fines, our fines range from $0 on majors, from $0 up to $1,000. A jail term can range from 0 days all the way up to 3 6-month consecutive, I think. And a 50 cent DUI. So we we do adjust, the judge adjusts according to the circumstances and everything else. I would submit that the city would not go bankrupt if we didn't have the fine money someday. As far as the alternatives, I agree with Senator Burns, and that is that, one, it is difficult to perform alternatives at municipal forms, at least at our level. I'm not talking about when Portland has the probation office. We do send people down to the Group of Detoxification Center, to those we think can benefit from it. We do send them to the district court, the driving school, the alcohol school. We do run maybe 7 conditions sometimes on a suspended sentence for both private care of the VA hospital.
Who supervises?
I do.
Okay. So you can't really.
That's correct. I can't. This isn't true in everybody. I mean, we're not saying that the Point City for 3 months. We attempt, and I admit that you're right, that it's very difficult for municipal courts to form the alternative. I think, however, that if the state has programs, that municipal court can simply, you know, send them into the state programs the same way anything else. At least those are my comments in those two areas. I admit the alternatives. We do have the public defender coming to Washington County now, and as you know, I think in Multnomah County, part of the success, if you view it success, his program is the very
bottom
of
the
Dillers is the ability to provide some sort of alternative to the traditional jail. I've talked to Mr. Hennings, and hopefully we can develop that in the county. He'll be available under the terms of the grant to take X units of felonies and X units of misdemeanors, and I intend to see if we can hook him at least for the alternative portion. We don't have a problem with the indigent in Florida who is not in counseling or public defenders. We don't have that problem, but I'm more concerned with Mr. Hennings' alternative program, quite frankly.
I think we ought to, since the chief appointed that subcommittee, I think we ought to ferret out all these traffic departments that she's going to assign to the subcommittee, and that we should sit down between the three of us and whoever's on the subcommittee and reach some sort of a consensus with respect to what our objective is, and then pick out which of those bills will serve as effective vehicles.
I agree.
I think that it's all part of a very complicated overall problem that has ramifications with respect to state funding, with respect to where courts are, with respect to alternatives. You know, if the state had truly implemented the regional jail concept that we passed the session bill for the corrections division in Kansas had responsibility for jailing and including financing on a regional basis to put the cities and counties out of the jail business and that cost off its tax base, then there would be a further sense of and a clearer identification of what the problem is. But I think we should pull them all out, Dick. We should sit down. We should formulate our concept and then decide which bills we want to use as leading.
She had these scheduled for today, and I suggested that, but she wants to go ahead because he said, well, how did John from Beaverton here? You're a pretty good-sized town. And so that kind of the mail on these columns that we're talking about here today. As far as finance is concerned, we have the present statute provide that when a city police officer makes an arrest, you get half the dough. Now, would you really make money on that?
We might. We might. We've never, costed it out. When you say cost, maybe a fifth of my time is spent on criminal matters besides traffic and, typical assault sort of conduct.
But I believe that we ought to consolidate police departments, too, to do away with the city and maybe have the...
Wave my home rule banner. Incidentally, I'm not I'm not suggesting there's home rule questions in here, Senator Atiyah asked me, and I don't mean to suggest that we're in here to home rule at all. Mr. Roberts, on his comment, one is that they favor, the District Attorney's Association favors 284 because basically these are crimes. We view, I say we, myself, at least a municipal judge, we view anything where it's a deprivation of liberty as a crime. That's, I mean, if a man can go away for one day, to him, that's the same as a crime. Statewide concern, no question about it. The other thing about putting the major traffic offenses before a legally trained judge, I stand to be corrected, but it's my understanding that in all cities over 10,000, there is an attorney as a municipal judge. In the city of Beaverton, it's a requirement of our city charter. You must be a legal trained person. And I would think if you look at the statistics on the major five major traffic, is that 90% are probably handled in the cities over 10,000, which have legally trained judges. The question that Senator Burns on this fiscal impact, no question of the fiscal impact. I ran through the arrest records on driving under the influence since I was city attorney in the city. 1970, there were 23 arrests. 1971, these are calendar years, there were 49. 1972, 137.
What were
these offenses? These are driving under the influence only. Reckless is not as many, of course. Drive on suspended probably a little bit more. 23 and 70, 49 in 1971, 137 last calendar year, and so far for the first 3 months of this year, we're running about 20 a month, so that'd be about 240 for the year. And if you send 240 cases over to Mr. Robinette, I don't know personally if he'd be happy to receive them. We send a shoplifting over, he doesn't want them.
Well, is your point, sir, mainly that they're to accommodate a lot of other cases?
I think that's
true. You're not saying that they shouldn't go there.
My approach, and I agree that you need something more than a piecemeal approach of plugging in here and doing it here, is the bill we testified on earlier, Senate Bill 677, where you'd have the ability, the cities and the counties and county commissioners to contract in effect with some of these offenses. If the city of Tigard wants to enter an arrangement with the circuit court or a district court, fine. You can reach these accommodations and not, you know, just blame everybody in there and hire six more district attorneys or three more judges.
Before I finish, supposing that there was a penalty for driving without a valid license, there was almost equivalent to a felony. Both you had everything else except that one, and every time your cops stopped a person that didn't have a license, that was a serious crime. You took those out of your court. Would that, in a few years, achieve the same goal?
We would have the problem of State versus Brown on the same transaction test as to, for example, splitting two offenses flowing from the same traffic offense, one in district court, one in the municipal court. This is a real problem with us on hot pursuit cases now because our boundaries are nightmares. It is partly due to our
I got a feel for that too.
Annexation laws should be made more flexible, and it would, if believe it or not, that's a very good end product of a sound, workable annexation law. Is the police on a typical intersection sometimes, two quarters may be in the county, the other two inside the city, and depending where the car land. And we do have cases of assault on an officer in connection with the hot pursuit chase, and we do have the jurisdictional problem. So if you split one major from the other major, you might have a problem for drug
dealing. I had
Captain
Tishman, I forgot your new title, but I know it's getting late. I'm sure we're going to have you back to help us with everything. I've forgotten your new title, Captain.
Oh, I just got to jump to major.
I didn't know what came next.
One little more money, that came next.
With that,
I had one other comment, but very brief, on the question of penalty, increased penalty. By doing it this way, our penalty provisions are exactly comparable to the state code. We don't have that problem. And I would say it's only a situation where the penalty is greater than that the judge would probably, under Judge Eunice's opinion, put the lesser sentence than the major, which is normally the case. The state is higher than that.
We're going to have to rest with this again. Okay. I hope you help us some more.
Thank you
very
for
much.
Your attention.
So you got to pull in your speech for me while I listen to the major?
Senator White, member of the committee, I made this major petition to the state police. I'm going to be very brief. As far as the bill that was just being discussed about the state courts, it doesn't concern us because all our cases are taken to state courts. But I would address ourselves to Senate Bill 283, which puts major traffic offenses into district courts in those counties where there are district courts. I think I understand probably what this is for, but I don't think the results would necessarily be as beneficial as what's intended from the statement that Senator Burns has already made. But let me point out what could happen. I'm talking about areas of Government Camp, Florence, Lincoln City, Oak Ridge, Sweet Home, Cottage Grove, Reachport, Grants Pass, Coquille, Gilcrest, and Hermiston. Now, the Sandy Justice Court to Oregon City District Court is 22 miles. Now, this is 23 miles from Government Camp to Sandy. This is an added round trip of 44 miles. This isn't too bad. Take an area like Hermiston. Now, we utilize all the city jails. We arrest somebody, we incarcerate them in a city jail, intoxicated drivers and so forth. And we don't want to travel any long distance with a person that's intoxicated and causing trouble. We like to put them, incarcerate them as soon as possible. There is a justice court in Hermiston. The closest district court, of course, is in Pendleton. We incarcerate them in Hermiston, as an example, then we have to transport this individual the following day or the following court day to Pendleton. We go to Pendleton and we arraign this individual, and a trial is never held on that particular day. Bail is posted, perhaps. Then it takes another trip or perhaps another two trips before the trial is held. We have a situation at Gilcrest. We have a traveling justice of the peace, for instance. It takes care of several different communities. It's 96 miles from that particular area down to the district court in Klamath Falls. All right, but no, we don't have it. So we transport this individual. Under the law, we can take him to the nearest district court, which would be Bend, and we would utilize the Bend district court. Other major traffic cases, a lot of them are cited in the court. They're not incarcerated. The individual is given a citation. If they happen to be someone that lived in the area of Gilcrest, we would, of course, cite him to the justice court right there at Crescent. Otherwise, this individual living in that area would make a 100-mile trip down to Klamath Falls to appear in the district court. And in addition to that, the officer's time in going this additional 100 miles on one or two particular instances where the case could probably be disposed of, and in a lot of instances, with an equal degree of justice that would appear if you went to the particular district court. So you have, like Senator Burns is saying, you've got good justices of peace, some of them pretty well trained, and some of them even attorneys, and conversely, too. So we would oppose this particular bill based upon that situation of additional time that it takes in transporting people in arraignment, the added round trip mileage from these particular places, the administered justice when our people could be utilized out there enforcing the law in the particular interim rather than traveling additional distances to appear in court on these particular violations.
In your experience, do you think that if this procedure was followed as suggested in 283, that it cut down the number of violations?
283?
Well,
number four.
Yes.
The district court yes. Found there's justification also.
Nothing like
no. As a matter of fact, the, it's been previously stated here, the district courts now are so overloaded with drunk driving cases. I just got a record the other day on dispositions, and I'm running them in four different locales. Cases pending for months and months and months that we can't even get them to trial. Senate Bill 351, the reason this came about, and the only comment I made was from the district attorney of Jefferson County. Made the request, and I will explain what happens presently on the prior to arrest are concerned, on if a felony has been committed or a major traffic offense.
351?
Yeah, this is hospital, Senate Bill 351. The major traffic offense, felony or a major traffic offense has been committed, and we also have reasonable grounds to believe that an individual committed can affect arrest. What happened in this, one of the district attorney Forkham, has run into problems in the prosecuting of these particular cases because they're making an issue out of driving a vehicle, and the defense counsel has brought this up before the judiciary, and he's lost some cases, even though the individual was in actual physical control of the vehicle. It may have been stopped right in the middle of the highway in an intoxicated condition. No one else around, nobody in the automobile. He's the only person there. And by using the word actual physical control of the vehicle would eliminate part of the problem in the prosecution, according to District Attorney Fortin, in overriding this particular issue of actual driving the motor vehicle.
Was this language on line 17 the best language you can get to still protect the rights of the individual and see the goals?
We're already doing, as far as the arrest is concerned, we're already making the arrest.
You're prosecuting him now, going to the jury on circumstantial evidence and convicting him of 95% of the cases. The car is stopped, the guy's behind the wheel. That's adequate evidence to go to the jury. I prosecuted people on that basis and convicted them. Particularly now with the point blank with the give a breathalyzer, I don't see what's the problem. But
he's not driving.
Well, maybe the engine's warm.
This is what the issue was brought up with this district attorney on. And part of you is what the district attorney
had. Is that the only place where they had the taller was over Jefferson County? Or the Chief County?
I don't know. The District Attorney Association may know more. I don't know.
It's a customary defense tactic of defense counsel to zero in on that point if, in fact, there's no actual eyewitness to the driving per se. But Senator Burns points out his camera right back on.
He points out in this letter that he said, I was just glancing through the November, December 72 issue of Case and Comment.
He
came upon an argument titled The Alcohol Driver. In it, there was mentioned Section 11-9022 of the Uniform Vehicle Code, which provides not only penalties for driving while under the influence of intoxicating liquor, but also for being an actual physical control of any vehicle while under the influence. And then he goes off and explains this particular problem. He says, I feel an amendment to 43-992 covering the control concept would alleviate these problems.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Major. Is there anybody here that didn't want to testify that wasn't signed up? We're kind of running
yes,
past time.
Senator, I would like to respond to one of Senator
Burns' question. Real brief,
yes, I will. Very brief. I am Judge Wayne Thompson, municipal judge here in Salem.
Thank you, Tom.
I made a written comment to the Transportation Committee, but I didn't realize it was coming before this committee at this time. I believe, Senator, as you have stated, that this is a piecemeal attempt to alleviate a problem that exists. I don't think it would be effective. I think that the entire system must be examined, and that this is the only way that this can be effectuated, because we're not going to solve any problems as far as the people in the communities are concerned if we only take the major traffic offenses out. Now, there has been some depreciation of some of the other offenses. There are still offenses which are not statutory major offenses, but which are serious offenses that would still remain in the justice court or the municipal court. Now, speaking to the matter of the alternatives really presently exist only in about four locations in the state. Portland, the metropolitan area with its money, is one. Eugene, with some more of that money, is another. The remainder are all only through local and usually voluntary action. For instance, in the city of Salem, the state capital, we have essentially two means of treatment for these matters. One, we have the court school on alcohol abuse, which, speaking to the state courts, I, together with the mental health division, some of the individuals of the Marion Polk Yam Hill Council on Alcoholism and Temecula Community College were instrumental in setting up. That's one. The other is the treatment program now being instituted by the Marion Polk Yam Hill Council on Alcoholism together with some AA groups, and now we are finding some help from the state hospital through the voluntary actions of some of the physicians there. But the alternatives, notwithstanding the espoused policy of Chapter 622, I believe it was, of the 71 laws, wherein alcoholism is designated as an illness and not a crime, and the areas of assistance set forth there, there is no assistance from the state in this area and many others, and consequently it is on a local basis, not through the state or the state courts, that these are being implemented. So I would say that as far as the local concern with these matters, it's a matter of state concern as far as the crime is concerned, what constitutes the offense, perhaps the punishment. But we're leaving everything to the local concern at this point as far as the alternatives. And the alternatives go far beyond fines and imprisonment. I think that the entire spectrum in this area must be examined and not the piecemeal approach that is given here. Now, I would say one thing with regard to 283, and Mr. Ashmanski touched on it, as did Mr. Mattis. The last section, the last phrase in that paragraph, or dealing with the same offenses or conduct. Now, Mr. Ashmanski addressed himself to the first provision, but the provision or dealing with the same offenses or conduct would appear to mean that no city could even, by reference, adopt the state statute as an ordinance. And consequently, there would be no offense outside those controlled by the state statute. There would be no offense in these areas that the city would have any jurisdiction over for prosecution or any other purpose.
I think that's
the right. That's correct. I spoke with Judge Ellis about this, too. That's all the time I'll take.
Unless
there are questions. I would appreciate that. Being informed of further.
Well, thank you. Good
journey. I am so tired, but I gotta go.